All right, everyone, I'm going to go ahead and get us started here. We may have a few more speakers joining later on. So welcome, everyone, to our second FOMC panel of the year. There are a lot of things to touch on today, so I'm really excited to get our panelists' takes on recent data and how things kind of look going forward. Now, as those who frequent our spaces know, I like to keep these panels very open for discussion. So as we go along, panelists, feel free to chime in with your thoughts in between topics or after another speaker is finished. The only request that I have is that we keep microphones muted while others are talking so we can avoid any overlap or background noise. So with all that said, I'm going to go ahead and introduce the speakers we have up here now. Like I said, a few more may join later, but if not, these three fine folks should be more than enough. Start us off here. We've got the Last Bear Standing, returning again. He's a frequent friend of our spaces. Last Bear is an expert on markets, where he writes about monetary policy in his weekly Substack. If you're not subscribed to his Substack, go do that. Welcome back, Last Bear.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me. It's always an honor to be included here on the panel. So I'm looking forward to the discussion this afternoon.
As am I. Thanks again, Last Bear. Next, we've got Michael Cao, the Chief Investment Officer and Portfolio Manager of Cao Family Office, and an expert in commodities, index arbitrage, and dynamic hedging. One of the most quotable people on the planet. I love his little tidbits. Sometimes he's got a little snarky comment with his data. Always cracks me up. Welcome back, Michael.
Funny. Thanks for having me, as always. I always look forward to having a great discussion on these panels, and you guys do such a great job of moderation. Appreciate it.
Hey, I couldn't do it at all without you guys, man. Thanks, Michael. Next, a great source of charts and memes, we've got Sven Heinrich back. He's an active guest on CNBC as well, sharing his takes on all things macro. And he has the best damn trail cam footage on Twitter. I'm pumped to have you back after what seems like forever. Welcome, Sven.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me back on. Look forward to the discussion. And yeah, trail cams, that's where all the action is these days because volatility remains crushed. So I got to stare at deer and foxes and all that.
The whole storyline of the fox and the two stags, man. Couldn't get enough.
That was funny, wasn't it? Never see what you never know what you're going to get. So it's always kind of a fun exercise.
Absolutely. All right. We'll have one more speaker coming up here shortly. Johnny Matthews of Super Macro. Johnny has decades of experience in macro portfolio management, and he currently runs his site, blog, and service at Super Macro, where he publishes in-depth market analysis and economic developments. That affect the macro landscape. And he even publishes his monthly portfolio returns. Grateful to have his macro fundamental and investment management experience with us today. So I'll be excited to get Johnny's takes as well. So before we get started, everybody, I just want to get a quick macro overview of the last month since our last FOMC macro panel. Gold and Bitcoin prices have rallied to all-time highs this year. The federal jobs report saw the U.S. adding 275,000 jobs, with unemployment hitting 3.9%, up from the 3.7% reported in January, while ADP research showed wage acceleration for job changers has gone up. It's seen that wage acceleration for the first time in over a year. The equities market remains very strong, as I'm sure we've all seen, blowing past prior all-time highs, along with the semis driving massive gains, while the consumer price index for all items rose by 0.4% to 3.2% in February before seasonal adjustment. So, with all of that said, I want to jump on here with the main topic right out of the gate. Now, Fitch Ratings has said that they expect both the U.S. Federal Reserve and the ECB to cut rates three times by a total of 75 basis points by the end of the year. Some, however, have voiced quite the opposite. So Jim Bianco recently appeared on CNBC discussing his stance that the Fed will not be cutting rates in 2024, citing the strength of the economy, consumer spending. And it seems like his stance has been that the Fed is unlikely to change policy, especially during an election year, stating that maybe at the earliest we'll see November or December for rate cuts. So I'm curious on that take, and I want to start with Michael here. Would you agree with that, Michael, that rates are unlikely to cut this year? Are you leaning a little bit more in line with Fitch ratings by a total of 75 basis points by the end of the year?
I lean with Jim's thesis, with one caveat, which is the political situation. So I tweeted out yesterday that I said that, look, if it were based on the data alone, I would say that the data alone justify no cuts or even hikes at this point. And even before this latest slate of CPI data, back in February, I tweeted out a bunch of charts that my friend Lakshmi had pointed out, maybe like four or six different high frequency indicators of various indications of, you know, inflationary inflections higher that seem to have predicted this resurgence in CPI and PPI. But to Jim's point, I think because of the upcoming elections, I said yesterday that the activation energy required to overcome this inertia of either introducing a package of a round of rate cuts or not is unusually high, because, you know, if the data don't give them enough justification to cut and signal potentially a round of cuts by June, I think in order for them to remain nonpartisan, they're likely not to do anything until end of year, or maybe even until 2025. Now, that said, I think the Fed is really stuck in a bad place, because, you know, I've written at length about how the phenomenon of U.S. economic resilience spells trouble for the rest of the world in particular. In fact, I talked about two different bifurcations to watch for. Within the US, one key bifurcation is what I call between the haves and the have-nots. And I'm not just talking about between rich and poor, though that is certainly a very significant bifurcation, but it has to do with, you know, the sectors of the economy that are very rate sensitive versus those that are not. So when you look at, for instance, commercial real estate, companies that are very, very levered, they're having trouble. But when you look at the equity markets, which are ever powered by a narrower and narrower breadth of large companies that have huge net cash positions, they are clearly the haves, right? So that's one bifurcation. The second bifurcation is the U.S. and the rest of the world, because the U.S. economy as a whole is much stronger than the rest of the world. And I think that this spells trouble, especially for Europe, which is already in deep recession, especially Germany. And I think that every central bank has been hoping upon hope for the Fed to do its work and engineer a global slowdown. And it's the transmission mechanism is very uneven between countries. And because of all of this fiscal stimulus that we're getting here, that the rest of the world isn't necessarily administering in their own economies, you're seeing the transmission of our monetary policy through the rest of the world by a strong dollar and through a strong dollar. And I'll just one last note, and I'll step down. You mentioned that risk assets, especially equities, have already priced in dovish outcomes. And certainly you're seeing that in Bitcoin and equities and also commodities. Well, in oil, I follow very closely. And oil in 2021, I'll note, I think was one of the key sparks that lit the what I call structurally inflationary dry tinder that in turn spurred on spurred the Fed into action and led to US dollar wrecking ball 1.0, where the Fed outhawked the rest of the world. My base case right now is that the US dollar wrecking ball 2.0 comes from the rest of the world potentially outdubbing the Fed, with potentially the ECB diverging from Fed policy in June. So I guess we'll see very soon whether that happens.
Beautiful. Thank you, Michael. Michael Gayed, I see your hand. Thanks for joining us last second to fill in here, man. What were your comments on what Michael said?
Well, I always love guys named Michael talking. I'm a big fan of Michael. Kyle. Good to see you, Mike.
I sense no bias here at all.
No, not at all. I think the name Michael means gift from God, which anyway, would say that's not true when it comes to me. So actually, Mike brought up two words, which I think are important to stress in the context of the name of the space. Bifurcation and then divergence, things that are diverging. You do really have a really odd environment, right? It's more than just now the divergence of rich versus poor. It's large versus small. It's small caps versus credit spreads. There's a lot of weird disconnects that have gone on here. Now, I've made this point before in appearances in my own writings. I don't see how the Fed can possibly cut rates until credit spreads widen. Now, entering November, when I myself was peak bearish, right, when I said I think there's that risk of a credit event, VIX was rising, credit spreads were starting to rise, it looked like something could have happened then, and then between the Treasury six save and then Powell getting the market to think that six cuts were coming, they essentially flooded the system with liquidity without having to do a single thing on policy. That had real big implications on credit spreads, meaning the differential between junk and AAA got even tighter. Now, that's unusual. We just went through the fastest rate hike cycle in history. A lot of people will say they could have seen stocks and bonds would sell off in this cycle together. I don't think anybody could have said that would have occurred with credit spreads at cycle lows. Now, the effect of very tight credit spreads is inherently inflationary. So if, and by the way, that shouldn't be surprising, right? You had this massive run-up in the market cap weighted averages since November. I will remind people that most stocks are still way below their 2021 levels. Micro caps, small caps in particular. And the wealth effect is inherently inflationary in and of itself, right? So you've got credit spreads very tight. That's inflationary. I'd argue that the Fed wants to see credit spreads widen at least somewhat, because that would be a disinflationary, deflationary force, at least at the margin, that would help them out. But if they do it here, they're going to risk another big wave. Now, this does get to be tricky. Okay, because you still have, it's funny how people seemingly forgot about this debt refinancing wave that's still coming. Every day that goes by, you're closer to more and more of this leverage having to be rolled over into higher for longer rates, which is the very reason, by the way, that small caps don't look like they're in a real bull market, because of the zombie company dynamic that's held back these highly levered, low margin companies that may not be able to survive rolling over their debt, right? Which goes back to why I said there's divergences. The credit market's not worried about credit. Small caps are worried about credit. It's true that you would normally give the benefit of the doubt to the bond market, meaning to credit spreads being right about default risk. But, you know, even though they tend to be the smartest in the class, they're not always right. So doing anything to cut rates here with spreads this low makes no sense. It risks another wave of inflation. Waiting too late in case small caps are right becomes problematic, because that could be the final, you know, spike, credit event, VIX spike that I've been warning about, just time-wise, hasn't happened just yet. So it is challenging. This is a very unusual environment. The final thing I'll say real quick is, I really do believe that this dynamic with Japan is a much bigger deal than people realize. I think the Bank of Japan is far more consequential at this point in the cycle than the Federal Reserve. Anything that they do here is not going to be enough. And you see that with the yen reaction. And since we talked about oil briefly, you know, the yen keeps on doing what it's doing against oil that's rising. That means oil in yen is skyrocketing for a country that pretty much imports all of its energy. There's a real risk here of the Bank of Japan at some point having to panic, to intervene, to try to slow that down by saving the yen, that could have all kinds of nasty implications and butterfly effects, or as I call it, a Mothra effect, the Godzilla movies, on the global carry trade. I don't think people realize how much leverage Japan has enabled for decades and how this could be a significant change in all that going forward.
Thank you, Michael. A lot said there. Does anybody have any comments to what either of our fine Michaels have said? Maybe Johnny?
Yes, thank you. Can you hear me okay?
You sound great.
Okay, excellent. A number of points. First of all, the Fed has always said that the, you know, there's a long and variable lag between the time when they actually change policy and its impact on the economy. Well, they did the first 425 basis points of hikes in 2022. So by 2023, by the second half, we should have started to see some sort of impact. And we had GDP growth that was north of 4% on an annualized basis over those two quarters on average. And that is because I think the household sector and the corporate sector have been well insulated from the Fed's policy actions. Households, as you probably know, the average mortgage rate on the outstanding stock of mortgages is something like 3.7 or 3.8%. So the household sector is not being impacted by these rate rises to the same extent as it is, for example, in the UK, where we have fairly short-term mortgage fixes of 2 to 5 years. And there's, it's a similar situation in Europe. Different countries have different standard fixing terms, but they're nothing like 30 years. And for the corporate sector, notwithstanding this bifurcation, which is correct, between the zombie companies, if you like, which are going to struggle with higher rates, and the rest, if you look at the net interest paid by the corporate sector as a share of total corporate profits in aggregate, it's the lowest it's been as far back as I can see, which is several decades using Fed data. So I think the problem the Fed has is that their rate tweaks have had much less of an impact than they might have liked on the economy. And that's because I like to say there's been years of abuse with monetary policy where rates were held at zero for the best part of a decade. And all that QE compressed the term structure, just left yields flat as a pancake. So corporates could term out the debt, household could term out their borrowings. And so those rates are for the most part locked in, those low rates. So, you know, when it comes to the question of, do I think the Fed should cut? There's two things. Whether they should or not is kind of beside the point. It's what they will do that really counts. And I think they will cut because the increase in household wealth, certainly in the fourth quarter and certainly over the last 5 years, has been enormous. And that has had a stimulatory effect because households don't need to save at the same pace that they used to save. Their wealth has gone up so much. You know, 4.8 trillion in the fourth quarter of last year, something like 40 trillion or so over the last 4 or 5 years. That is a reflection of the easing in financial conditions. Now, if the Fed doesn't cut, if they don't go ahead and follow their forward guidance, I think we'll see quite a severe sell-off in fixed income and equities that will lead to a tightening of financial conditions, and that will impact both the cost of funding for corporates and the household sector. So I think they're kind of committed to these rate cuts, and they will go ahead. In my mind, they'll do at least two, maybe three, and then we'll see how things lie towards the end of the year.
Thank you, Johnny. Does anyone else have anything to add to that? This seems like a pretty diverse topic. Maybe Les Baer, Fenn?
Well, some thoughts here in terms of how this all has unfolded here in the last 6 months. Keep in mind, just in September, Powell was talking about how higher rates were doing the tightening job for the Fed. He seemed quite pleased with high yields as they were unfolding, and we had corrective activities in markets. And as you may recall, you know, the Fed was, speaker after speaker was talking about higher for longer and so forth. So they all were on this kind of same Page, except for Janet Yellen, who came out and said higher for longer, but not necessarily a given, which kind of marked the end of it all, because what have we seen since? Just a complete reversal in everything, massively loosening of financial conditions via liquidity injections, which basically, by the way, started much earlier than that with BTFP in March for the bank rescue. But even before that, we saw some of that come around in October of 22 when markets actually bottom. At the end of the day, it's all about liquidity. And you have the usual part of the cycle is when you have that peak in yields in a cycle and then yields reverse, you get a big market rally. That's been standard fare. And that part, no surprise whatsoever. What has been the surprise here is not only the extent of the rally and the concentration of the rally is just this absolute drop in loosening of financial conditions, which in my mind has absolutely exacerbated everything and is posing a major challenge for the Fed, because you are now risking that with all the wealth effect and, you know, obviously you have massive market cap expansions across the globe, what, $12 trillion in the US alone. I mean, you have to ponder if that does not have a reverse effect on inflation. And that's kind of what we started seeing a little bit. As you may recall, in January, the first inflation data came out that was a little higher than expected. And first it was all about seasonal factors, but now the second round of inflation data came out, and that came a little hotter as well. But markets are ignoring everything at this point. And this is where things starting to veer off a little bit and has me a bit cautious now, because, you know, we've been on the bullish train about all the historical aspects of it. But notice there were very close relationships going on all through the last couple of years. You know, how the dollar was acting, how yields were acting, everything. But that's all shifted. You know, note the dollar went up this year, didn't matter. Yields went higher this year, didn't matter. We even had a slight period of tightening of financial conditions in recent weeks, and that didn't matter either. The S&P keeps ticking, and the market keeps ticking in a very specific program, we call it. I mean, it's so predictable at this point, it's almost laughable, and it doesn't react to anything. And the trends are as tight as we've seen them, with volatility very much compressed. What is the one factor that is consistent? And it has been liquidity in the sense of two aspects of it. One is this gigantic U.S. deficit the U.S. government is running. And in essence, Janet Yellen is a bit fighting the Fed, because that fiscal impulse that we're seeing is of a level we've never seen before. Typically, you know, you have that type of fiscal stimulus when we are in a recession and the government needs to react and so forth. But we're kind of in this doom loop because yields are higher and debt has to be refinanced and all this debt financing has to take place. So deficits are massively higher. And in fact, it was 6.3% debt to GDP last year, and they are not stopping this year because they have an unlimited debt ceiling until next year. So when everyone refers to this also resilient U.S. economy, you know, we're all subject to an experiment here where I'm wondering if we're all having rose-colored glasses on and basically, you know, seeing an economy that's actually not as hot as it seems to be because of that fiscal impulse. In fact, if you look at a number of economic indicators, this is where it gets really interesting now, because a lot of the Fed speakers started hinting at, you know, we don't want to cut too soon, but we don't want to cut too late, because they're still worried about the lag effects themselves. Because if you look at industrial production, retail sales, commercial loan growth, you name it, or Philly Fed even here, manufacturing, all these indicators are showing an economy that's not expanding, it's not growing, it's actually showing slight aspects of contraction, which is incompatible, you would think, with all this earnings growth that Wall Street has now baked in for the rest of this year. Because actually, if you look at GAAP earnings, they've improved slightly last year into this year, but it's certainly less than it was at the previous highs in 2022. So there's a multiple expansion gap here. So you need to see the economy actually expanding with these expectations that are built into expanding earnings, and it's not there. And so you have a conflict here because the Fed is worried about cutting too early and too late at the same time. The growth is actually not there, although growth appears resilient because of fiscal stimulus. And now you're in a position where all of a sudden, because of all the wealth effect, you may see inflation picking up again, and then the Fed's trapped and cannot cut until it's forced to cut, which is the typical cycle, right, when things break. And so I think we're kind of all in a very unusual path here in this regard, how this is going to play out. Short of it, I don't think they can cut right now at all without cutting their credibility. But, and this is with regards to liquidity, tremendously important. To the extent that markets have been running off, not only on the fiscal deficit, but also the liquidity comes in from reverse repo draining. And once that reverse repo is drained and that liquidity gets cut off, the Fed may be in a hurry to stop QT altogether. Because the net impact, frankly, has been, despite QT running passively in the background, the net liquidity has been improving. And we see that with regards to bank reserves. And even some of the Fed speakers have been hinting at that. In fact, there's been a paper out from the New York Fed itself that they know that once the reverse repo drains, bank reserves will drop. And guess what happens with that? Markets drop. And that's the only way they can kind of fend that off is stop QT altogether to kind of be more liquidity neutral. So this is why I'm looking forward to seeing what they're saying about QT today. While they may not end it, but they may give some sort of time frame about maybe tapering it in anticipation of reverse repo draining here in the next maybe 2-3 months.
Thanks. I just wanted to revisit this, the loosening of financial conditions that Sven brought up, because I remember when we were doing this space back in December, being so puzzled by this surprise, what I call rhetorical pivot by the Fed, because at that time I was basically saying that, you know, look, I was so puzzled by it because it seemed like such a bad risk reward action by the Fed, because you knew that it was going to loosen financial conditions and make assets just rip, but at the same time without having any sort of benefits, right, to government, no interest savings, nothing, right? And so now they are trapped in this situation. So I do think that, you know, from a logical perspective, I would think that they need to pull these dots back to have any sort of credibility if they truly want to cut. And, you know, I was so puzzled by that rhetorical pivot that I floated this conspiracy theory that, you know, maybe it's Jay Machiavelli Powell who, you know, leans on the more hawkish side and wanted to teach his fellow dovish members a lesson by, you know, letting them, you know, broadcast their dots and then essentially lead us into this position where the data just can't allow them to cut. So I think it's a very interesting conundrum facing the Fed right now. And one thing I'll point out that Michael Gayed brought up is the issue of credit. A couple of weeks ago, I wrote a piece called Private Credit and the Ostrich Effect. And it talked about how, you know, what I call the leveraged credit trifecta in the United States is made up of essentially three equal slices of, call it rough, you know, 1.4 trillion of high yield, 1.4 trillion of leveraged loans, but now anywhere from 1.5 to 1.7 trillion of private credit. And private credit has exploded. And in my piece, I talked about the reasons for it, right? People don't like to mark to market, blah, blah, blah. It's just all this liquidity has piled into this space. And, you know, a bunch of you guys already talked about how, you know, transmission mechanisms for monetary policy are very different. And I wrote a piece about that too, talking about how, you know, in the United States, there are the haves and the have-nots, but even the have-nots are being refinanced out in private credit. So I observed that, you know, some of the riskiest triple C tranches of leveraged loans were basically being taken out by this new private credit bid. So it is definitely lengthening the life cycle of the zombies. And, you know, I agree with what Michael said wholeheartedly. I think usually for the Fed to overcome its activation energy to really act, because again, a first cut is not just a cut, it signals a package deal, signals a round of future cuts as well. For them to overcome that, there needs to be some sort of urgent reason to do it. And certainly, and usually it's always from some sort of credit crisis. And we have the opposite of that right now. The credit markets are just in a super sanguine situation, which is incredible to me at this stage of the credit cycle.
Thank you, Michael. Last Bear, do you have any comments here before I pass on to the other Michael?
Yeah, I just wanted to pick up on some of those comments. So I think it's a great point that a number of speakers have made around sort of the dot plots in the different ways that the Fed actually sort of messages its policy. And we tend to focus, obviously, on the federal funds rate, which is important, but also obviously the dot plot is their version of forward guidance. And there was an inflection point about 18 months ago, September, I think, of 2022, where that dot plot started to actually be inverted, as in the dot plot was sort of sloping down going forward. And essentially saying at that point that the future path of rates at some point in the future was going to come down. So the Fed was effectively messaging cuts as far back as 18 months ago. And so when you look at things like credit spreads that people have mentioned, or the practical sort of all-in yield or all-in cost of borrowing for a low quality credit, those haven't increased in the past 18 months. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that the Fed has effectively said that rate cuts are coming if you guys can just hold on and wait. And the market obviously listens to that. So I agree with what Michael was just referencing also with respect to the December dot plots and how that might have, how I found that surprising as well. But that I think what we should look at in this forward or in the meeting that we're going to have here in half an hour is really how those dot plots move, because that will impact the long end of the curve, which has remained inverted this entire time, you know, below where short-term rates are. And a lot of that has to do with that forward guidance. And so when we think about why is it that these, you know, rate hikes haven't had the effect that many people thought that they would, my argument would be partially because the Fed hasn't actually hiked rates on the long end of the curve, which is much more practically relevant for sort of real economy borrowers like mortgage buyers and corporates. And so when we look at that end, there hasn't really been tightening in a long time. And the Fed has given sort of free rein, especially in the last dot plots in December, to continue to loosen on that front. And so I think that's a critical avenue of policy and messaging that we should continue to keep a look, you know, continue to keep our eye on, in addition to you know, just whatever the short-term funds rate is.
Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, real quick, I have to hop on, and I appreciate you guys bringing me up. Sometimes the simplest answer is the right one, and since the term conspiratorial was brought up by Michael Cao, I'll put it out there that maybe whatever happened in November, December is something that nobody knows about except the policymakers, meaning they were worried about some kind of risk and were trying to front-run it. I don't actually think that's that far-fetched. I'd argue that gold and Bitcoin, this is prior to the Bitcoin ETF, you know, hype, were also sensing something in October. So there might have been something that we don't know about that caused this rhetorical cut to Michael Cao's point. Final thing I'll say is it's an election year. The Fed probably doesn't want to be seen as being political. So they probably, if they are going to really cut rates, would love a scapegoat. I have floated that idea before that if I'm right about this reverse carry trade playing out, which was always originally my thesis around a vol spike, a credit event, spread widening moment, Japan becomes their scapegoat because of global financial conditions and volatility rising and them having to do what they always claim that they try to do, which is save the system when they created the conditions that broke it. So thank you, everybody. Appreciate it.
Hey, I appreciate you coming, Michael. Thank you. So here, I do want to kind of kind of spin down those topics of the RRP and quantitative tightening, because it did come up in a lot of those cross discussions. I will pivot to credit a little later as well. But for now, since we were on that topic of QT, I do want to touch on the relationship between the RRP and QT. Now, as RRP funds decrease, some investors are beginning to raise concerns that QT might eventually impact asset prices. Now, if I understand correctly, the RRP funds still have some months less, but what happens when it does run out? I want to start with Sven here and then kick her around the panel. I know Last Barrel probably have some comments here too.
Well, it's interesting because liquidity is a difficult beast, and markets have a way of just following trend until it breaks, right? I mean, it's you know, we have not only obviously liquidity going in, we have the unique aspect now of 0-day options. I mean, we see days where just markets are so programmatic, it's almost hilarious, because that's why no news item sticks, and liquidity is basically the pool that allows all this to take place. I've watched RRP, there was a different relationship at some point last year when Janet Yellen was obviously desperate to issue debt following the whole debt ceiling issue and delay, and that caused some pressure on yields at some point. But at some point, they were pretty clever in how they managed that and then let yields drop. You know, I sympathize with the comments on conspiracy when I hear that sometimes, in terms of, like, for example, Powell's sudden pivot in December. One thing I've learned to pay very close attention to over the last 2 years, and I've made jokes about it on Twitter with VIX charts and Janet Yellen comments, because she comes out and she's concerned about something that's the end of the VIX. Hence my earlier point about when every Fed speaker came out talking about a higher for longer, and then she came out not necessarily a given, and that was again the end of yields, basically. There are agendas. I'm not being in a position to accuse anyone of anything, but it's pretty obvious we are in an election year. And no administration wants to see markets bomb or a recession to take place during an election year. We've seen that movie before, and it doesn't end well for existing administrations. So that's not to say that things are overtly manipulated, but certainly not going to do anything that causes trouble, or to the extent that they can avoid trouble, they will do that. My contention is obviously that by doing so, you may be distorting things in a very unhealthy way. And on one of those ways that we're all confronted with here from a societal aspect is that that we have, on the one hand, officially tight monetary policy for retail, meaning the larger population, which is now facing the most unaffordable housing market ever, thanks. While the asset owners, top 1% and above, are seeing this dramatic loosening of financial conditions and record asset prices. And again, one of my long-term macro bearish contentions is that we just keep running from cycle to cycle, exacerbating wealth inequality while we keep driving ever more debt up and hope nothing breaks. I have to admit myself, when I saw, this incredible aggressive rate hike cycle after they were caught asleep at the wheel with inflation into the highest debt construct ever, I would have thought they're going to break something. The fact that they haven't, and this all keeps chugging along seemingly without anything breaking, I have to say it's impressive at this point. I would have thought something would have broken. But then if I listen to, again, Janet Yellen and what happens every time she spoke, once you cued into that, it was pretty clear the jig was up. And fighting that was probably hazardous to your financial health. You know, they've been very successful of managing this all without any major breakdowns. In fact, anytime the market got ever close to anything majorly technically breaking is when it got saved, every single time. That's why I called it the most controlled bear market ever. And just maybe concluding on that statement, I would say it would really irk me if we're coming out of this particular cycle and the lesson learned by policymakers is, hey, we can avoid any recession or any bad news by just piling into ever more debt and it being consequence free, because then that's your basically playbook for anything going forward. And unfortunately, that just keeps the wealth inequality aspect going, because it'll just keep melting up asset prices by the sheer force of fiscal stimulus. So I'm a bit baffled at this stage that all this has been consequence-free. It concerns me now that we've disconnected from all the various other correlations before. This rally is now long in the tooth. We've seen long rallies before, but this has been pretty much now the longest in 50 years without any, at least basic corrective type of activity. I would think we would see some here in the next few weeks, but so far, just the technical indicator, the weekly 5 EMA keeps holding tick for tick every week. It's pretty impressive. But my sense is we're getting to the point, at least technically speaking, where the market will want to see some basic rebalancing on some MA reconnects and so forth. That doesn't need to be dramatic initially, but we're certainly due for something in terms of rebalancing it. And as was mentioned earlier, small caps and other stocks that are more sensitive to higher yields and the economy actually slowing in the background, that is something that still has to be negotiated as well. We are very thin in leadership, probably some of the thinnest leadership we've ever seen. And you know, that always opens up the possibility you're going to get at least a little head washing down the road.
Thank you, Sven. Go ahead, Johnny, and then I'll pass it to PPG for some comments as well.
Yeah, a couple of things. For all this talk about the economy is really slowing, I'm not sure that there's that much hard evidence for that. Job gains in the last 3 months averaged 265,000. That's 20,000 more than the average in the prior three-month period. Pay growth, using the Atlanta Fed measure, is still running at 5%. That's higher than inflation. So the household sector is enjoying real income gains, strong real income gains. I spoke about the wealth effects earlier. So that's point number one. And point number two, what I hope is that, okay, maybe the Fed does signal rate cuts, but I hope some journalists ask relevant questions. Like, for example, previously, you know, you were focused on the 6 months annualized rate of core PCE inflation. Well, you know, Mr. Powell, what do you have to say about the last 2 months jumps in the super core or even the core measures of the CPI that made two consecutive outsized monthly jumps? So when you put it all in the mix, the question I come down to is, what is the need for these rate cuts, other than the fact that you want your forward guidance to maintain its credibility, so you feel you have to go through with what you've signaled? But otherwise, I can't see any desperate need for these rate cuts.
According to a Reuters poll, 14 of 26 strategists projected that the Federal Reserve will begin tapering QT from June 2024 onward. Is this realistic, or do those other 12 polled strategists kind of have a better grasp on the situation? I do want to kick this one around the panel, but let's start off here with Last Bear.
I think it's a reasonable outlook, and that ties back to some of the dynamics that folks have touched on earlier about reverse repo and sort of the amount of dormant liquidity on the sideline that still has potentially yet to come into the system. And so I guess just to kind of frame the discussion for folks away from just the acronym. So basically a lot of the money that was effectively printed during the pandemic ended up sitting on the sidelines in something called the reverse repo facility. That's a relatively new aspect of monetary policy. And because of how it sort of works and its interaction with the banking sector, basically is sort of put money on the sideline. And that money has since come back, flowed back into the market over the past about 9 months, basically since May or June of last year when the debt ceiling was lifted, for some technical reasons that I don't know that we need to get into here. But it's basically counterbalanced the effect of QT for much of the past year. And it's actually led to sort of increasing bank reserves on balance. So when folks have mentioned that liquidity has been sort of increasing because of these dynamics, that's sort of what they're referring to. So the question for the Fed is, given that the past year has been, you know, quantitative tightening has been largely offset by this sort of inflow of cash on the sidelines, it sort of has neutered the effect of it. But what happens going forward to the extent that the reverse repo doesn't have any more funds to give? And so currently there's about $400 to $500 billion left in the reverse repo facility. That's about a quarter of where it was, maybe, like I said, in June of last year. So most of that has gone away, but there still are reserves there sitting. And so the question that folks have sort of referenced is, going forward, to the extent that that reverse repo facility is drawn down to zero or near zero, and there's different views as to when that will actually occur, whether that's in the next couple months or whether that could be significantly longer, is what does the Fed do with QT? Because that, theoretically, at that point, quantitative tightening would start to have the more typical impact that we would expect to have in normal course, which means bank reserves are falling and there's more of a sort of direct tightening effect associated with it. And so I think that it's reasonable that the Fed, particularly given sort of some concerns that continue in the banking sector for small and regional banks, that they will be cautious when it comes to continuing QT beyond sort of the limits of the reverse repo facility. And so I think there's a view that they could extend QT by effectively slowing its pace, which is sort of what you're referencing in the question. Obviously, that would extend the duration, but it also limits the impact of it because you would be sort of drawing less money out in any given month, but sort of extending the time period for which you could theoretically do that for. And then there's another view that the Fed just doesn't really care. They view bank reserves as being ample, and that they can just sort of continue at the current pace of QT, which is effectively about $80 billion a month at sort of current rates. And they'll just let that run until something happens or they decide that the policy isn't necessary from sort of a policy perspective anymore. My view, I think that the people polled were equally split between those two. I don't think that we're going to get any clarity on that topic for at least a couple months. And I think at that point, I think it's reasonable to expect that there may be a tapering of QT, but that comes with sort of, like I said, a lesser impact. So it's sort of one half, six or one half dozen from my perspective. I'm not sure it's the biggest driver from where I sit.
Thank you, Les. Bear, Michael, do you have any comments on that?
Obliquely, if I could just go back to something that Sven was mentioning about this push-pull between Yellen and the Fed. If I could borrow a mental model from one of my favorite COVID hobbies, which was mixology. So look, Janet Yellen and Jay Powell are two mixologists making a vodka Red Bull. Jay Powell is administering the vodka depressant, but it's being counteracted by way too much Red Bull from Janet Yellen. And so you've got this ridiculous situation where it then begs the question, does Jay Powell need to administer more depressant? And at the end of the day, you just wind up getting wrecked, right? That's basically this push-pull vodka Red Bull model. I just want to mention one thing to think about as we're about to go into this presser. To me, the black swan isn't Jay Powell actually pulling back the dots. I kind of expect him to, actually. I wonder, and this is an idea that I'm going to say was inserted into my head by my friend James Aitken a couple weeks ago. I fear that Jay Powell announces an early retirement. And that would be a true black swan to me, because why would he do that? Well, let's think about it. It looks like on the face of things, he's done everything he set out to do. He's taken inflation from 9% down to 3% and change. Unemployment is still below 4%. There's been no major disasters. And oh, by the way, there's this presidential election on the horizon, and Trump has vowed that if elected, he would essentially disembowel Jay Powell. So Jay Powell is independently wealthy. He doesn't need this shit. He's done a great job. So I could see that happening. And the reason why it's a black swan to me is that the complexion of the FOMC has become more and more dovish. And if you get somebody, God forbid, like a Lael Brainard inheriting the reins and goes into full-blown easing mode, even as inflation is showing some signs of resurgence, I think that would be a real disaster, because it sets us up for a very, very stagflationary type of situation.
Thank you, Michael. Johnny, any comments there as well?
Well, I tend to agree that I think there's too much concern over the RRP, to be honest. That RRP used to be close to zero a few years ago, and it will go back down there without any major impact. It's mainly used by money market funds. They have to stick the money somewhere. If it's not in the RRP, it'll be in T-bills. And there is the standing repo facility that was introduced in 2019 to avoid there being a squeeze in the overnight rate. So if there is some kind of shortage of liquidity, banks can turn to the standing repo facility, and that will keep the overnight funds rate within that 25 basis point band that where the Fed wants to keep it. So I actually think all this concern over the RRP draining away is just not warranted.
Thank you much, Johnny. So we've got about 8 minutes here until the numbers drop and about 38 minutes until the presser. I want to take a quick moment to just kind of tippy tap the topic of the U.S. 10-year. Now, Last Bear, you tweeted earlier this month that the U.S. 10-year hasn't budged since mid-February. And aside from a quick dip to, I think it was 4.08% on March 8th, that still rings true now as it sits around that 4.3% mark. However, some speculate we'll see it trend up again, and soon. I think it was Jim Bianco who's saying he expects 5.5% sometime this year. So, Last Bear, I'd love you to touch on that topic for us a bit here.
Yeah, and I think we have seen a little bit of movement over the past couple months, maybe since I tweeted that. But I think it's a critical question, because sort of tying back into some of our earlier comments about forward guidance and the dot plot, it really has to do with what expectations are for the longer term path of monetary policy and maybe sort of the longer term neutral rate, whether we're in a sort of an actual long-term inflationary dynamic, which some people believe, or whether we're returning to sort of lower growth and lower inflation, like what we saw for a lot of the past sort of 20 years prior to COVID. And so where the 10-year is today is obviously based off of an expectation that short-term rates are going to get cut and will stay at a lower level than, you know, substantially lower level than where they are today, in order to justify taking sort of a lower yield on a 10-year today versus what you can just get for the overnight rate. So you're locking in to a, you know, 4.3% yield for 10 years because you think that that's going to be advantageous to, you know, sort of whatever the rolling overnight rate is over that 10-year period. And so I think that that's a very important economic figure, because it's much more related to things like mortgage rates and borrowing costs for corporates than even the overnight rate is. And so the Fed has done a very good job of sort of holding the tail down despite sort of lifting near-term rates. And so the question about where the 10-year goes from here, I think, is a really pivotal question for sort of the impact of monetary policy throughout the economy. And to the extent that the Fed dials back on its dot plot projections, or whether the market continues to view inflation as becoming more sticky and more sort of on a longer term trend upwards, then I think that it's reasonable to expect that the 10-year rate could go back to 5% or higher, like what we've seen. And so I think that is sort of the key variable that we're going to see come out of these decisions, is where that 10-year rate goes. And I don't know that I have, that's not really a very specific answer as to where I think it's going to go, but I think it's fully reasonable to, you know, that it's within the realm of possibilities for the 10-year to go back above 5%, given that the, you know, short-term rate's 5.3% right now. And at the same time, if the Fed continues to hammer home its expectation that the neutral rate is more like 2.5% and that rate cuts are cutting, then I think the market will be content to keep, you know, keep the longer term yields at the levels where they are today, or even lower.
Thank you for that. Last bear, apologies. Nicholas is just trying to rejoin. Michael, do you have a point?
I do. I wanted to slightly disagree with Last Bear on the trajectory of the long end vis-a-vis the dot plots. I actually have the opposite view. I feel that if the Fed pulls back its dots and waxes somewhat hawkish, you may actually see the longer end compress in yield. And if the Fed doubles down on potentially cutting, I think that's where you see the long end potentially blow out as a signal of no confidence. In my head, I'm using the model of the late 70s to the early 80s, because in that period of time, from call it like 79 to 81, you saw, you know, a very aggressive stair-stepping of, you know, Fed hikes followed by bear steepening in the long end. But then by beginning of 1982, when the economy was already in deep recession, but inflation had not been necessarily cured, the Fed cut, and then the long end completely blew out in a bull steepener. So at that point, it's almost like semantics to argue whether it was ultimately a bear or a bull steepener. But the fact is that the long end massively steepened. So I kind of take the opposite view of what happens to the long end, depending on what the Fed does.
So maybe if I could just respond to that, I totally understand that the reaction function couldn't be opposite, you know, can be the reverse of what might seem logical. And I totally understand that perspective. I guess my counter to that would just be that the long end, at least over the past hiking cycle, seems to have sort of maintained more anchoring because of, you know, where the dot plots have gone. So that if you look at the spread between the federal funds rate and sort of the longer term estimate in the dot plots, that's been a reasonable predictor of sort of where the long end has traded in practice over the past couple of years. But to the extent that, you know, whether there's a capitulation moment where the market decides that the Fed is simply making a bad decision and is entrenching inflation longer, maybe we see that reaction function reverse.
Thank you, Last Bear. And Michael, Sven or Johnny, do you have any comments to what was said there at all?
Well, I agree with that. That sentiment that if the Fed gets too dovish unnecessarily,
then I think we could see that. That is the thing that could send the long end sharply higher. And I think that's the problem that they've got. Perhaps looking at the economic data, the hard data that we've had, there isn't really a desperate need for them to start this cutting cycle. But I think they will anyway. And that is the danger here, that the long end becomes somewhat less anchored than it has been up to now.
So kind of on that topic of cuts here, as data should be dropping in under a minute here now, Michael, I want to pivot back to you here. Just kind of something you mentioned before that gave me a chuckle is that the Fed is going to have some serious cognitive dissonance to justify cuts this summer. What's the cause of that cognitive dissonance, and what do you think justification would be?
Well, I mean, they trapped themselves here with that December rhetorical pivot. Like I said, I felt that that was an totally unnecessary and inexplicable move to me, because, you know, they loosened financial conditions and undid a lot of their work without actually reaping any of the benefits from an actual pivot. And so now it's going to be, they're going to be in a very uncomfortable position where if they echo to Super Macro's point, if they want to maintain their, I guess, any sort of continuity from that December rhetorical pivot, they're going to be forced to justify cutting into what seems to be a dramatic loosening of financial conditions already. I just think that they did that unnecessarily. And if, ironically, if they truly want to cut and err on the side of not cutting too late, they actually need to pull back that rhetorical pivot somewhat. So I guess we'll see momentarily. So
it looks like they did opt not to cut here in March, which I don't think that came as any real surprise, citing the need for greater confidence that inflation is moving back to target. And so while panelists kind of mull over here the numbers that just dropped, I actually want to talk a little bit on that inflation target. So 2% has been, you know, the constantly touted target for inflation to get down. My curiosity here is inflation seems to be kind of sticking at that 3% mark, with some people speculating, some much more loudly than others, that that 3% may have been the bottom out. So as we kind of mull over the numbers here, any panelists, feel free to chime in on this one. Is that 2% target still a possibility, or is it more likely that 3 is the bottom out? Go ahead, Johnny.
Well, I would say this, that I think given the choice between maintaining inflation at 3% or driving it down to 2% with a significant economic cost in terms of spike in unemployment, significantly lower growth, I think the Fed would be okay with inflation at 3%. They're never going to say that they've changed target from 2% to 3%. They'll always say, yes, we're still going to try and get inflation down to 2%. But in reality, if the economic cost of achieving that is too great, I think they'll stick with 3%. And the second thing that I would say is that if you look at the, you know, getting back to my earlier point, the recent increases in the monthly CPI at the core level, the super core level, and so on, those are quite concerning to me, because we had some very, very small increases in the core measures of CPI in, I think it was May and June of last year. And those will drop out of the trailing 6-month window or the 1-year window, however you want to measure it. So the annualized rate of core CPI inflation, once those very low prints drop out, will pick up. And to me, I don't see that inflation is on a path towards 2%. That's all I have to say on that.
Thank you, Johnny. Now, been about 5 minutes since the numbers, so I'm curious if anybody has any initial thoughts on what they're looking at. Sven, anything standing out to you?
New all-time highs. Yay. As I said, the market is like Pavlovian, you know. We'll see if there's going to be any different reaction following Powell's press conference. But no, they've done nothing, and I guess that's good enough these days, as long as the liquidity aspect keeps flowing. Look, on the yield front, you know, just keep in mind historically, you know, there's a two-part dynamic here. One is the peak in yields, as I mentioned before, in a given cycle, providing relief. This is when you see asset prices run. And we've seen that time and time again in cycle to cycle when the Fed then pauses. What the Fed typically does is they come in with rate cuts when they're forced to, when something breaks. And that's when yield relief turns into yield terror, because then the economy is actually heading into recession. Typically, what we've seen during high inflation episodes is that you actually do see recessions manifest themselves, because you, in order to get rid of the inflation drivers, you want a slowdown. That's typically what happened with Volcker and everybody else before. You know, and of course, the Arthur Burns scenario in the 70s was they thought it was all over, and then they loosened too early, and then inflation came back, and that was a disaster, right? And that's what Powell actually seemed to indicate. He did not want to repeat that mistake. That's why he kept referencing Paul Volcker in 22 as his guiding principle. That's why what we're seeing right now is so ironic, because we have all these loosening financial conditions. We've got asset prices going wild and inflation picking back up, because that's not what he wanted to see originally per his guidance. So it's all a bit confusing from that perspective, because no one can decide, because can claim that risk appetites are not seethingly hot here in everything that we're seeing. And nothing's really been, you know, cleansed or right-sized or whatever. Amber referenced housing earlier. It's the most unaffordable ever. So what's going to happen if they cut rates? Well, there's going to be more housing transactions, and housing prices are going to go even higher. And they've not, you know, made themselves affordable. So basically what you have is, I hate to say it, middle class getting screwed again while the rich keep getting richer. Great, great job there if you want to pat yourself on the back with that. So no, I think we need to keep a close eye on yields in the sense that, okay, they have not produced a fear of a recession yet, because the economy is still holding in, although there are some warning signs. But again, as long as the liquidity equation with reverse repo, and I have to disagree slightly with what was said earlier. Yes, generically, it's not a big deal, but to the extent that reverse repo has, the drainage of which has added liquidity, and therefore that liquidity distorted the price inflation equation, if that liquidity inflow then suddenly disappears, you got a vacuum. And this is what the Fed itself has indicated they're concerned about, that then bank reserves will drop along with QT. That's why they want to taper QT to kind of offer that backstop. So I hate to say it, with all these machinations going on in the background, the asset price inflation aspect is very managed, because they're all carefully working on the triggers of liquidity. And we cannot be immune to that. We cannot be ignorant of it. And so far in 2024, liquidity has trumped everything. And my concern is that it's now disconnected from the correlation that we've seen before. And at some point, you know, imbalances can last for a long time, but at some point you're going to get some sort of rebalancing, which I think would be healthy. I'm not calling for a massive bear market or crash. I think everything is very bullish, very controlled. I think just a little bit of a pullback correction would be a good thing to kind of get away from as much excess as we've seen, especially in some of these individual stocks, because that's not long-term healthy, and you don't want a larger accident, because we've seen those before as well when things just get too hot. So that's kind of my two cents.
Jim, thanks for joining us here, man. Do you have any comments on what's been said since you've tuned in or on the number drop just now?
Yeah, thanks for having me. A couple of things. The Fed did drop their statement. Their conference call starts, or press conference starts, in 20 minutes. And there's a contradiction here. They upped their forecast on growth. Growth is going to be stronger than they think. They upped their forecast on inflation. They expect more inflation in 24 and more inflation in 25. But then they said, we're still going to cut rates three times this year. Well, there's only six meetings left this year, and they're going to cut three more times, even though they're saying that the economy and inflation are both stronger. So these things are not in agreement with each other. So that's probably the first thing that Jay Powell is going to have to square away. So you think things are getting better and you think we're going to have more inflation, but yet you're still committed to cutting interest rates. Please explain. You wanted confidence that we were going to 2%. You just raised 2% inflation. You just raised your inflation forecast, moved it further away from 2%, but you still want to cut rates. Please explain. So I think that that's going to be probably top of the list for the Fed to have to explain why they seem to be so insistent on cutting rates. And the last thought I'd give you on this, there's six meetings left this year. One of the meetings is July 31st. That's between the conventions, the Republican and Democrat convention, and the other meeting is September 18th. Historically, the Fed does not want to be part of the narrative of the election. So it would be reasonable to argue they want to sit those meetings out. All right, you got four meetings left and you're saying you're going to have three rate cuts and the market's not pricing that in. So we're going to have to do some adjustments here based on what Jay Powell says here in about 19 minutes when he starts talking.
So Jim, actually, I have a quick follow-up to that. In an interview that you did recently, I think you hinted at that you somewhat expect rates might actually go up this year. Is that accurate?
Yes. Let's talk about, when we talk about rates, let me break that down. Yields. I do think yields are going to, yields being the 10-year yield, is going to continue to go up. Let me back up all the way. I'm in the no landing camp, which means that the economy is going to stay at its trend, if not slightly above its trend growth. And as such, I think that there's no need for the Fed to cut rates. So I expect that the funds rate will end the year probably with no rate cuts at 5.5 or maybe one at 5.25. I also expect on the yield side that we should probably start to see the 10-year yield start to converge with the funds rate. In other words, the yield curve would become less inverted or steepen. And that's why I think that interest rates could eventually go to 5% on the 10-year yield, if not higher, before the end of the year. All things being equal, if the Fed was really honest about this, and if Wall Street was honest about this, if we are going to see 3% inflation continue, and I think that that's what we're going to see, we should be talking about more rate hikes. And we're not, because we've all invested, we being the collective of Wall Street, in that we want rate cuts. We're starting with a conclusion. We want rate cuts, so go find me some data to justify it. If we're not careful and we continue on this, the Fed's going to pivot, the Fed's going to pause, the Fed's going to cut rates, and this is what we've been doing for the last 2 years. We continue down this road, we're going to wind up with much more, we're going to wind up overstimulating the economy, and we're going to wind up with a lot more inflation. Last word for you on this, the Congressional Budget Office just put out a study recently, and they looked at the inflation rate by income levels. And the lowest 20% of income in the United States spends a higher percentage of their income on housing. And because of that, their inflation rate is running somewhere between 4.5% and 5%. The top 20% spend less of that money on housing. Their inflation rate is running close to 2%. That's why all the rich people on Wall Street keep saying there's no inflation, because you don't spend a lot of money on your housing. If you're in the poorest camp, you spend more in it and you have higher inflation. This is why inflation has to come down, because what we look at with the CPI is the average. And we have to recognize that the poor are paying more than the average when it comes to inflation. They're not getting enough of a raise at work to keep up with it. This is why the president's approval rating is down. So this is why I think that the focus has to be on inflation and solely on inflation. It's not acceptable where it is now. And if it doesn't come down, we need to start thinking about ways to make it come down, and that would be rate hikes. But we don't want to talk about rate hikes right now. We want to talk about 100,000 on Bitcoin, and we want to talk about the stock market going up, and we want to continue to see things get stimulated, because we, being in the upper class, you know, that have houses, that have portfolios, don't see the inflation. And I understand that argument. We don't see the inflation, but we have to kind of think about what it is the Fed is trying to focus on, and that is the overall inflation problem. And at the bottom end, it is really problematic for them.
If I could just add a comment to Jim's point on the unaffordability to the lower end of the income spectrum. I mean, it has to be noted that CPI is a rate of change in price, and changes in CPI is a rate of change of a rate of change, right? That's the second derivative. So when you see CPI start come, the rate of change of CPI coming down, I think a lot, some people don't necessarily understand that that does not mean that price levels are coming down. So, and that's the difference, right? So slowing of CPI increases is disinflationary, but for the affordability issue to actually get fixed, you need some deflation. Now, I'm not saying that the Fed will ever allow a prolonged bout of deflation, but this talk about, you know, 2% versus 3% is, I think, would be crazy if they actually move the goalpost, because the compounding effect of just that incremental, 1% is significant on the absolute price level.
Let me just add real quick what Michael said, that when you say that people don't understand the rate of the second derivative rate of change, that when it goes from 3 to 2, prices are still rising at a lower level. That also includes whatever intern is writing President Biden's tweets, because they've been tweeting out on his account. And obviously, I'm implying that President Biden is not tweeting out on his account, that companies are screwing everybody because the inflation rate's coming down and they're not cutting prices. So they don't understand it either. So they're compounding this myth that 2% inflation means that prices need to fall. No, they rise 2%. They used to rise by 3%, but they still keep going. And yes, that compounding effect, that's why people have gone to that new metric of over the last 4 years. Now, maybe that's the last election, but it's also the end of the lockdowns. You know, prices are up 25%, but your paycheck's probably not up 25%, especially if you're in the lower end. And that's why you're so angry about what's happening with the economy.
Johnny or Last Bear, do you have any comments to what Michael and Jim just spoke about?
I would just add from maybe a market perspective. Obviously, we know that the market swings on these announcements, and the initial move is not necessarily the final move. But it is. It does seem that basically there's no real surprises out of the Fed. Maybe a slight increase, but a very marginal one in the dot plot. And at the same time, as Jim mentioned, there's increased growth expectations and a slight increase in inflation. So equities seem to like that so far. We'll see if that holds. And then basically yields haven't moved at all. So which is pretty surprising, given that they usually swing about 10 bips on these things one way or the other. So it seems like there's maybe a bracing for a little bit of hawkishness given the recent uptick in inflation. But given that that hasn't come through, that's being initially seen as a positive for equities, and the bond market seems content.
You're right about that. I just to say, you're right about that rates are really muted on this reaction, but maybe we ought to be patient, because when Jay starts talking, then we could get that move.
There's a bit of a tell, though, I would say, in the TLT, if you look at that as a proxy for the long end. I mean, the algos originally took it, it spiked up on the presser, especially with that, with the one more dovish dot. And then there's already been the one big figure reversal. So pretty interesting.
If I could throw in one other thing too, the Fed talked about at their last meeting in January that they would begin a discussion about quantitative tightening. Remember, quantitative tightening is the Fed has about $7.5 trillion of securities on their balance sheet. Every month, over $100 billion of those securities mature. They reinvest those matured securities less $95 billion. So they let their balance sheet decline by $95 billion a month. That's how we get quantitative tightening. And that is a removal of liquidity from the financial system. They're talking about maybe ending quantitative tightening. So no announcement today about it. They began the discussion. That's what they told us in January. They'd begin the discussion. So I expect Powell to be asked or maybe even volunteer some discussions about where you're going with this quantitative tightening thing. What Wall Street seems to be expecting is May or June, they'll make an announcement that they'll, the fancy word we use is taper it. It'll go from $95 billion a month, 1 month, to $80 billion the next month of reduce, you know, buying back securities that mature less $95 billion, less $80 billion, down by $15 billion a month, you know, then $65 billion the next month, all the way to zero. That's what Wall Street thinks. Powell is going to probably have to tell us either, Wall Street, you're on the right path with the thinking, or Wall Street, you're off base. We're thinking about something completely different, like not doing quantitative tightening, or maybe not tapering it, ending it all at once or something. So that matters on the margin because this is a liquidity-driven market, and that is about liquidity. So we'll have to see if he gives us any clues as to which way they're leaning or thinking when it comes to quantitative tightening.
Johnny, I see you unmuted there. Did you have some comments as well?
Yeah, this is exactly the result that I feared from this meeting. The Fed's raised its inflation forecast for this year and its growth forecast for this year because the data were telling it that, you know, we've already had such a strong start to the year that you've almost got stronger growth baked in the cake for this year. But they're still signaling three cuts for this year, and that makes the long end of the yield curve vulnerable. So we saw an initial jump in Treasury prices, but that's fading now. And I think as the market comes to its senses and starts analyzing what's really going on here, I think you will see long end yields continue to climb.
If I could add to that real quick, I agree with that. We also got to remember that the long end of the curve is highly sensitive to inflation. People say, well, of course the Fed's going to cut rates. They want Biden to win because Trump said he's going to fire Powell and they don't want that to happen. It's not that simple. If the Fed were to just on some random Wednesday say, okay, we're going to cut rates and we're going to stimulate the economy, and the market says, no, we're a little bit worried about inflation and you're going to stimulate the economy, you could have a very bad reaction in bond markets to that. So the reversal you're seeing, I know I'm talking about 15 minutes of price movement, kind of fits that. You told me that things are getting better. You told me inflation's going up, but you're still committed to three rate cuts. Maybe you're not serious about inflation. And if you're not serious about inflation, maybe I ought to rethink owning your 10-year note. And so that's the concern, or that's the balancing act that the Fed is going to have to play. You just can't come out and just say, we're just going to cut rates and we're going to stimulate the economy and it's all going to be good. It won't be if you do it and the bond market thinks you're not serious about inflation, because it won't be serious about owning your 10-year note, and then you'll have a real problem on your hands.
I'm loving this. Does anyone else have any other comments on that? Les Bear, Michael? So real quick, before we get to, you know, some closing remarks, before we send folks off into the presser, I just wanted to super quickly touch on equities. And a lot of these all-time highs we're seeing, some have been arguing, you know, it's kind of on the back of semis, companies like NVIDIA who are deeply investing into AI. And it's caused a lot of speculation that, you know, we're in a sort of bubble, not too terribly unlike the dot-com bubble. And so I'm curious from the panel as a whole, anybody feel free to chime in on this. Is it comparable? Is the whole AI situation that we've got going on, everybody's pointing fingers saying a bubble, it's going to burst. Is it at all comparable to the dot-com bubble, or are we seeing something different this time?
I actually wrote a piece about this. It's my pinned tweet. I talked about how it's very interesting. I'm not going to go into the weeds on valuations and whatnot, but one striking commonality that I see in today's market versus the 2000 era is this notion of, squeezing, hyping big demand into low float situations. And so, in the 2000s, you had high flying IPOs often float very tiny percentages of shares to create this artificial supply inelasticity, which really, exacerbated the up and down crash. One thing that I'll note is that this ETF-ification of Bitcoin and crypto is almost like the ultimate expression of that same sort of elephant through a mouse hole effect. And it's also exacerbated by passive in general, right? So ETFification of essentially any asset has that kind of an effect. So I do think that when the party ends, it's not going to be pretty, because I think it's the supply inelasticity built from this dynamic creates much more fragility in the markets.
Thank you, Michael. Any other comments on that, or even, just the magnificent seven stocks, as it were, kind of piggybacking the rest? I know we talked a little bit about small caps earlier.
I'll take a stab at a comment in that the magnificent seven is really collapsed down to the, fabulous four, and that, and within that, NVIDIA is somewhere around one third of the S&P's gains year to date. And it's about half of QQQ's gains year to date. In fact, the four stocks, NVIDIA, Microsoft, Amazon, and Meta, account for 100% of the gains in the QQQ's. The other 96 stocks collectively are down in the down in the year. In the Russell 2000, Supermicrocomputer and MicroStrategies account for a little over 2% of the gain in that one. And you take those out and that's down in the year. So really what you've got is you've got four stocks up and you've got 4,500 stocks collectively unchanged or down on the year. And when you get into very concentrated markets like this, where you just basically have a handful of stocks going up, and we saw this in the 70s with the Nifty 50s, we saw this in the 90s, we even saw this in the 1950s with the television stocks as well. That's usually the end of the move. And what I think it signals, when you combine it with another statistic, market cap to GDP is 181%. We have a $53 trillion stock market and a $29 trillion economy. There isn't enough money for 4,500 stocks to go up. That's why we've got just a narrow number of stocks going up. To me, that's why Wall Street's screaming, Jay, you got to stop QT. Jay, you got to cut rates. You got to ease. We need more money. We need those Russell 2000 stocks up. We need those other 493 stocks in the S&P to go up. And we're sucking all up of the money into, the Magnificent Seven and NVIDIA, and maybe even the Bitcoin ETF and a couple of other things. And that's about it. And then there's a couple of people over here that are worried about inflation, and they're pushing gold stocks to a new high, or gold, excuse me, to a new high. But if you want everything else to go, we need Jay to ease, and we need Jay to give us money. But the problem with that argument is, he does that and you have inflation, it backfires. So this is typical end of cycle stuff when you see a very concentrated market. But now that I've said end of cycle, that doesn't mean the cycle ends, next Tuesday. It could go on for many more months, but you are playing in the seventh, eighth, or ninth inning. And if you're a baseball fan, lots of things can happen in the seventh, eighth, or ninth inning too. But understand that that's where we're playing if we are in a concentrated market. And part of the problem is that the sheer volume of liquidity you're going to need to push up 4,500 stocks when you're already at $53 trillion is going to need the Fed to participate by easing or by giving you more liquidity, by cutting back on QT and cutting rates. And that is really why Wall Street's been demanding it for over a year.
Thank you, Jim. We've got about a minute until the presser starts. And for those of you in the audience, we will be playing the presser through here if you want to stick around and listen in. In this quick minute, real quick, any closing thoughts from the panelists, and please feel free to plug anything you've got coming out. Let's start with Michael here and power right through these.
Just thanks for having me as usual. I really enjoy these panels. You do a wonderful job of curation, and I appreciate all of my co-panelists.
And I appreciate you being here as always, Michael. Thank you. Last Bear.
Yeah, you can follow me here on Twitter. And if you like what I say, subscribe to my Substack. I also did write about the question of a bubble and taking sort of the opposite perspective that maybe we aren't so much in a bubble. You can read that on Substack if you're interested as well. So thanks, guys. I'll leave it at that.
Thanks, Last Bear. Definitely check that out, folks. Jim.
Yeah, thanks for having me. You can follow me on socials under Bianco Research or BiancoResearch.com is our research site. We also manage a fully invested fixed income ETF, WTVN, Wango, Whiskey Tango, Bianco Nancy. It's a Wisdom Tree total return bond fund. You could check that out. BiancoAdvisors.com is the website that explains about our ETF.
Thank you much, Jim. Check that out, folks. And Johnny, anything you want to push folks out with here?
Well, thank you for having me on the show. It's great to have a diverse range of opinions. Just one thing, you can follow me on Super Macro on Twitter or the website super-macro.com. I produce a daily newsletter and a weekend note, which is more detailed with some trade ideas and performance of the Super Macro portfolio. And I explore the macro and the implications to asset markets and the economy. So please check it out. You can get a 30-day free trial.
Appreciate it, Johnny. Definitely check all these folks out, everybody. You're going to learn a lot from them. Every time I'm here doing these panels, I learn more than I ever could just kind of, you know, watching the news and paying attention to the big names, as it were. These folks are the big names. So pay attention to what they have to say. You're going to learn a lot.